May it please the Court. On January 28, 2009, I stood at this very lectern in this very case. And this Court heard my adversary, Mr. Nassar's counsel, quite persuasively argue the clean hands maxim, that a court should never act in a manner that condones or aids illegal behavior. Indeed, as Chancellor Strine has said, it is not the task of this Court to aid parties in implementing schemes to avoid the consequences of laws addressing marital property relationships or their tax responsibilities. To do so would enlist the Court as an agent in conduct, subverting duly enacted laws and sully it. When my colleague stood here in 2009, what was the illegal behavior that he spoke of? Answer, a tax evasion scheme. What was the scheme that he spoke of? It was a scheme, as Vice Chancellor Laster found, designed at inception in 1993 by Mr. Nassar and his lawyer, friend, and partner, Mr. Shibboleth, by which Kids International, of which Mr. Nassar was the controlling shareholder, would send offshore over the course of its life from 1993 to 2008 over $35 million tax-free. Tax-free meaning that those payments were improperly treated as legitimate interest payments and payments to foreign licensees. The entire structure, as conceived of and implemented by Mr. Shibboleth and Mr. Nassar, was based upon one critical element, that the foreign payees were truly unrelated third parties. As Vice Chancellor Laster found at the subsequent trial, they were not. Who participated in this scheme? According to Vice Chancellor Laster, both Mr. Nassar and 5 years into the scheme, Ms. Dweck. And we agree.
Mr. Wachtel, help me out here in terms of what the record shows. The argument that the leadoff argument in your side's brief, and I gather in yours, is that the court erred in entertaining this case at all on grounds of unclean hands. Was that argued below? Was that argued to Vice Chancellor Laster?
It was not only argued, Your Honor, it's in our pleadings.
And he declined to credit that argument for what reason?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor.
And the answer?
The answer is that he went through a five-day hearing and made factual findings, all tied to that very claim. But he then ultimately concluded that it wasn't his responsibility to address the legality of the structure. As he put it, it's not my lane and it's not my job. Therefore, I'm going to assume that all of the testimony and evidence I've heard that graphically depicted the scheme.
Okay. Do you contend that the Vice Chancellor's refusal to credit your side's argument was an error of law, or was it an abuse of discretion?
It was an error of law for the Vice Chancellor to disregard the ruling of Vice Chancellor Lamb and to otherwise disregard the case law and precedent of the state that people with unclean hands will not be afforded the opportunity to have their wrongdoing adjudicated by a court.
Vice Chancellor Lamb made a statement. Is there any evidence in the record that there's been a determination anywhere that this was an illegal tax scheme?
The factual findings of Vice Chancellor Laster.
No, I understand that, this has been going on a long time. I assume everybody was concerned about this illegal activity. My question is, has any court, any government agency in any country, any state said, you people have been engaged in an illegal tax scheme.
We've been cooperating with both federal and state authorities, and I will represent to the court that in both instances, the IRS and the grand jury are still investigating.
All right, but to date, at the time of the trial, there's no record evidence of any determination that this was an illegal tax scheme.
That is correct. Okay. The facts.
We understand your argument.
Vice Chancellor Lamb understood, having had the case for 3 years and having presided over a trial, were the facts that were presented at the subsequent trial.
So your argument is, if no one's made a determination that this is an illegal tax scheme, yet the facts presented to you lead you to conclude that it is, you should stop and not proceed any further with the case.
You, the presiding judge, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And to do otherwise is to, in some measure, not only condone, but assist the wrongdoers. Now, in 2005, when Ms. Dweck came to the Chancery Court seeking a custodian and saying, stop, this $10-plus million in the bank, I've been thrown out of the company, fired, Mr. Nasser's in control, appoint a custodian, she wanted it stopped. And she was gone by May of 2005. During the very pendency of this case, from 2005 to 2008, the illegal conduct by Kids International as the tax
filer. Your argument is that the court erred as a matter of law in not determining that the conduct was a violation of the federal tax law, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
A state court commits an error of law by not finding that the federal tax laws have been violated, and instead electing to determine the merits of the case based on the law of the state, correct?
Your Honor, there's federal tax, there's state tax, and yes, I believe that it's the charge of the trial court to determine whether or not the underlying conduct is illegal.
All right, so we would have to find, if we were to credit your side's position, that Vice Chancellor Lasker was obligated as a matter of state law to determine a federal tax law question, correct?
No, Your Honor.
No?
I think it was his obligation to determine whether there had been illegal conduct.
Well, illegal under some law.
It would have been a matter of the
this is a tax. This is an illegality under tax law.
Yes.
And I assume that you didn't parse out very finely whether it was federal or state. I mean, the clear import seems to be that we're talking about a federal tax evasion scheme.
We actually parsed out the federal, the state, the city, because New York City doesn't recognize S corps. So we did very much parse it out. And
unless I misunderstood your opening comments, I thought you were telling us that the other side had made a party admission that there had been illegal activity.
They did.
So what is there for the Vice Chancellor to find in face of a party admission?
It's a very good question, Your Honor.
Indeed. It was argued to him, I thought, that the unclean hands doctrine, for lack of a better term, applied to this case, and therefore equity couldn't give either side it relief because both parties had engaged with unclean hands. Is that true or not?
It is true, but Vice Chancellor Lasker specifically ruled that he was not going to opine on the legality of the underlying conduct. He made the decision that it wasn't within his province to address that issue.
Well, what I'm trying to get a handle on, and maybe you're not the person I should be asking, but how does a judge sit in equity and say they don't have the province to entertain an argument that a party is engaged in activity that would bar them from equitable relief?
Your Honor, I don't know, and in this case you are that the query is compounded by the fact that Vice Chancellor Lamb could not have been clearer, having presided over a trial, saying there are allegations that in this case that I'm aware of They appear to go to the very heart of the dispute. It suggests a pattern of illegal activity. And if that proves to be the case, there is no judge. Whoever gets the case, it was Vice Chancellor Lamb's actual last day on the bench, who's going to sit in a court of equity and allocate amongst wrongdoers, particularly, not that he said this, but Vice Chancellor Strang, particularly when those wrongdoers have not only allegedly cheated each other, but together they cheated taxing authorities. So we found ourselves back in front of Vice Chancellor Laster after the case was remanded and after Vice Chancellor Lamb stepped down. And there was a five-day trial, and Vice Chancellor Laster urged us not to try it as a tax case, saying that it wasn't his lane, his words. But it was unavoidable, because the essence of the dispute had to do with the looting of the company and the fact that this tens of millions of dollars kept going abroad, and Ms. Dweck said to Mr. Nasser, look, you're taking all the money, you're taking a significant amount of money that would otherwise go to me as profits, and if I don't have the benefit of the profits, I have to find other ways to make money. And that was looked at great length, and that's when the Vice Chancellor Laster said that, yes, at that point, she acquiesced. And we agree that at some point, she accepted the fact that the monies would continue to go abroad. It was 1998. The conduct that was the plaintiff's, the case that Mr. Nasser brought, related to what she did after 1998. Now, what's interesting in looking at Vice Chancellor Laster's decision or opinion is that his findings suggest that he had concluded that it was a tax evasion scheme. Let me read to you some of the things he said. Page 7. Notably, for the tax avoidance structure to work, it was critical that Nasser, Dweck, and Heim not, his emphasis, appear to control any of the companies receiving the funds from kids. Quote, the intermediary companies were Malvi and Hakalar, were therefore structured to avoid any indicia of control. He, at some length, went on about Mr. Keilman was the intermediary. He got a 7% agency fee. And then he went on to say that the foreign entities were Mr. Nasser's, and that Mr. Nasser had provided all of the funding for these foreign entities by taking money from Woodsford, which was the investment arm of the Liechtenstein Trust. Those were the clear factual findings by Vice Chancellor Laster. He went on to say that as for the Malby loan, which was a $4 million loan but ultimately resulted in $9 million of interest, quote, not surprisingly, kids never made any principal payments. So $540,000 could leave the U.S. each year. Vice Chancellor Laster described the channeling of money, his words, out of the country, and generating tax deductions as a scheme, his word.
Mr. Wachtel, your quotations from the opinion caused me to circle back to a question that I had asked earlier, but maybe without the richness of the background that you supplied. Let's assume that you're correct, that the illegality of the scheme was established. And let's assume that that illegal scheme was integral to the cause of action or causes of action that were litigated here. The defense of unclean hands, all of which is that the defense of the court certainly could have, in its discretion, barred the further proceedings on the basis of unclean hands. That is an equitable defense, however. And isn't it the case that the court has discretion in deciding whether or not bar the action based on that defense? What I'm asking a second in a different way is, are you aware of any authority where an appellate court has found that a trial court of equity has erred as a matter of law and not in allowing a case to go forward and not barring it where the elements of unclean hands otherwise were established?
One does not come to mind, Your Honor, but I can't imagine a case where a court made all of the findings that Vice Chancellor Laster made and have the court nevertheless say, I am going to assume that the conduct was legal. It's in essence, I won't say turning a blind eye. I sincerely believe that for whatever reason, he did not believe it was his task, his responsibility to make that determination, both as a matter of the jurisprudence of the state, but also in the face of Vice Chancellor Lamb's specific ruling. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll turn.
Reserve the balance of your time?
I'm the cross appellee, so yes, I've reserved the last 10 minutes, correct? Thank you.
Okay.
May it please the Court. The appellants have structured their presentation to you today in a manner similar to their briefs, which is in a way that tellingly avoids any confrontation, let explanation in a convincing manner with respect to the primary holding from the trial court below, namely that there were multiple breaches of the duty of loyalty by the individual appellants in this case by starting a competing business to kids. That holding of the multiple breaches of duty of loyalty drives the resolution of the primary issues that are put up here on appeal today.
But the thrust of the appeal is that even if the court was totally correct in its evaluation of the merits, it doesn't matter because the defense of unclean hands should have caused the court to preclude itself from delving into those matters.
I agree with Your Honor in terms of the way that you're setting that up, and my response to you is that yes, that the issue still drives it, at least as to what is going on, the reason for the assertion of that argument today. And if I might, if it could be helpful, I think it's important with respect to this first argument, the alleged illegality, that we take a step back and look at the context of how the issue was presented below and the way in which it was addressed by the court. And I think that effectively took place in four events. Quickly, first, Vice Chancellor Lamb did not at any point hold that there was an illegal tax scheme, let alone establish law of the case. As Justice Holland, I think, pointed out, in terms of how he addressed that issue, he was discussing the possibilities that might exist, but was not resolving the issue. And that can be found at B284 through 85. Second, at no point did Mr. Nasser admit that there was an illegal tax scheme with respect to the distribution of funds and how they were distributed. Instead, what his testimony was, and we have it in our brief at page 19, was how, if anything, the manner in which Ms. Dweck reported her income after the distributions may be a potential violation of law. And that can be found, Chief Justice, at A132, 135, and 156 through 157. The third event is when Vice Chancellor Laster took the case over from Vice Chancellor Lamb. And there was a discovery hearing, I think about a month before the trial took place. And at that discovery hearing, the issue came up in which it was mentioned the possibility of the illegality of the tax scheme. And at that hearing, the trial court focused on the manner in which the fiduciary breach allegations are not related to this allegation of the illegal tax scheme. What he said was that it was his task to figure out who, what went to whom and when in violations of the breaches or in violations of duties of loyalty. And he held or mentioned, discussed, that based on how he was seeing things, that tax allegation was not really core to the resolution of the case. And that can be found at A633 through A635.
Let me just make sure I understand that. You're saying that he found, the Vice Chancellor found, that the illegality of the tax scheme, if that's what it was not core to a determination of the merits of the claim.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, I think it's the right question. What I'm saying is that before the trial took place, as the issue was coming up, the trial court looked at it and said that at least his inclination, based on what he was seeing at that time, was that the allegation that there might be an illegal tax scheme was not related to the core allegations in the case, the breaches of the fiduciary, the duty of loyalty, by starting the competing business. And what happened then leading up to the fourth event is the trial took place. And at that trial, the lower court foreshadowed how he was approaching and thinking about the allegations of the breaches of the duty of loyalty, the competing business that was started. And after that, as a result of the post-trial briefs at a hearing, on the post-trial briefing, the appellants flatly told the trial court that it did not necessarily have to decide the legality of the tax issue in order to resolve the case. Later in that same hearing, the trial court invited counsel for the appellants to submit a supplemental brief on the issue if it chose to do so. And it declined, or it did not file one that I'm aware of, working through and arguing the merits of such an argument. And that can be found at pages B836 and B837. And in that sense, Your Honor, it was one of the first questions I heard today. That issue was not presented in terms of the illegality of the tax structure to the lower court for resolution. Now, I point out to you that in the reply brief that the appellants submitted to the court, that at page 3, they go to some lengths to cite to a series of portions of their briefs in which they say that they raised that issue to the court. We invite you to look at those citations. Because when you look at those citations, they're essentially a discussion of a paragraph or two paragraph discussion of unclean hands. But there's not a discussion, not a presentation with respect to the so-called illegal tax scheme. And that, again, can be found at page 3 of their reply. Indeed, appellants never told the trial court below what they've told this court on appeal, which is that no relief should be awarded until the tax issue is decided. Which gets us back to the original point that we started with in your first question, which is, why do they push so hard? Why do the appellants push this argument so hard now on appeal, if the record is what it is below? And the answer is that this is the argument that they can put forward, or that they attempt to put forward, that does not have to directly confront the findings of the multiple breaches of the duty of loyalty. You won't see it in their briefs, any kind of fulsome discussion, and you didn't hear it once during the oral presentation here today. What they're asking you to conclude is that there are no consequences for those loyalty breaches that she committed, that Dweck, Taxon, and Fine committed, and that they don't actually challenge here on appeal. And it's simply not supported in the record. And I believe, Justice Jacobs, it is subject to a discretionary abuse of discretion standard in its review based on the way in which it has to work through the factual issues. If you even get there, based on the failure to present the issue properly to the court below. But that failure to confront the findings of multiple breaches of the duty of loyalty carry through to other important issues on appeal. For example, it carries over to the trial court's determination with respect to prejudgment interest. The trial court established a record in which he considered at least three different issues or factors in making a determination with respect to prejudgment interest and awarding the legal rate of interest compounded quarterly. And that decision is subject to an abuse of discretion, clearly. In going forward and issuing his post-trial order, he had a discussion with respect to the relative culpability of the parties, the potential cost of borrowing for the harmed company here, HIDS, and then the responsibility of the respective parties for the protracted nature of the litigation. Worked through each of those in the classic factual analysis of the case in crafting the remedy in the form of the prejudgment interest, discussing the relative culpabilities of the parties and finding that Ms. Dweck was the primary wrongdoer in this case. And in so doing, reached the prejudgment interest determination subject to the abuse of discretion, and there has been no abuse here. The third way in which that failure to confront the breaches of the duty of loyalty come into play have to do with an issue that we've raised in our cross appeal, and that's with respect to how the lower court shaped, went about calculating damages suffered by kids. And that's essentially the issue of the decision that the lower court made to award lost profits as opposed to valuation damages in the case. Now, there are two key findings that we believe that the trial court made that impact whether or not it should look to valuation damages or lost profits. The two are, the first is that Kids was, quote, crippled. You can find that at the opinion at page 1, destroyed at the opinion at page 19, or had to start over from scratch, the opinion at page 21. In essence, findings that the company was brought to its knees by the conduct of the individual appellants. The second finding that he had was the kids could have survived but for the appellant's breaches, and that can be found at page 36 of the trial court's opinion, in which he said that the appellants may have captured the kids' business, but, quote, it would have taken time, end quote, kids would have had an intact employee base, access to its records, and a much better shot at preserving, close quote, its business. Those two fundamental findings, that they were driven out of business, and that on the other side, that they could have continued if they had left properly instead of the way in which they did. But what the lower court did was that it decided to move towards a lost profits analysis and has a discussion in its opinion regarding the issue, and focuses on the fact that Dweck and Taxon were not restricted by any covenant of employment for leaving and going to another company. And I think one can glean from that discussion that there was a concern of using valuation damages if they could have left. And our position is, I hope, straightforward, which is that given case law that in Delaware and elsewhere talks about how valuation damages are the appropriate measure of damages in cases such as this, where the company is driven out of business, where it ceases its operations on a day-to-day basis, that the proper way to look at it is valuation. And what the trial court here did was, instead of focusing on the damage to the company, looked at lost profits and shifted its analysis for a going-forward basis to looking to the numbers, the financials, of the competing business.
Was the lost profits argument that's in your brief presented below?
I believe it was, Your Honor, with respect to both sides. In the first instance, valuation. Both sides had testimony submitted on the valuation issue. Now, what the court did, and I think it's an important question, what the court did was both sides put their evidence in at that trial. The court comes out in January of 2012 with its opinion and indicates that on a going-forward basis in the case, that there's going to be an accounting procedure. Makes specific reference to looking to lost profits for late 05, early 06. And then based on that, the parties have to file an accounting working through, based on the logic of the trial court's opinion. So in that sense, the issue of the valuation damages were put forward and argued, and the position with respect to what should be considered in terms of the damages was also put forward.
But there's an alternative argument also, as I understand it, and that is that even if we were to posit that lost profits was the proper method of computing damages, that the computation was wrong here because it relied on the actual profits that were made by Dweck rather than what the numbers would have been had the operation continued in the premises that were then under lease.
Because
was that raised below?
I believe it was. That essentially that the focus of the trial court incorrectly shifted to the financials of the competitor instead of focusing on the valuation. It had to be presented in the construct that the trial court created and that the parties and counsel respected in moving forward. But I believe that that issue was put forward to the court. Yes, Your Honor. And particularly the valuation damages argument through all the parties putting valuation evidence on during the trial. Because the two are connected in the sense that the point of the valuation damages cases are that they're asking for the trial courts.
Well, they're connected, but they're different methodologies.
They're absolutely different methodologies.
And the lost profits methodology and the argument that you predicate, that your argument is predicated on a particular way of computing lost profits, and all I'm asking is whether the court, had the opportunity to rule on that and did rule on it.
I believe it did through that accounting process in that second stage. I want to make clear and make sure we're on the same page, Your Honor, because I think I understand your point. The first issue is, was the argument presented to the court that the court should use valuation damages instead of lost profits? I hope we all agree that it did, both parties submitting that evidence at the trial. Then the question is, okay, once the court, in that first opinion, talks about lost profits, how did the parties proceed? And the parties proceeded through an accounting process to put forward their arguments with respect to lost profits. We simply make the argument, and perhaps create a little confusion, I don't mean to simply point out that in raising those arguments, which we did, the two concepts are related. The mistake that the trial court made with respect to the lost profits was the focus on the competitor's cost structure, for example, which functionally, if you think about it, they've been working in a parasitic-like relationship. They had been on the premises of the company operating a competing business. Then, after May of 2005, they're going out and competing with that business.
Now, I understand that argument.
Thank you.
That it artificially depressed the profits or inflated the expenses.
Yes.
All I'm asking is, did the lower court have the opportunity to rule on that specific contention?
I believe it was implicitly through. Yes, Your Honor. I believe it was implicitly through that accounting process, and we addressed the claim of waiver on page 11 of our reply brief. And so what we're asking the court to do, just to round out the thoughts with respect to the valuation damages decision, is that what we're asking the court to do is reverse and remand for further proceedings that are consistent with the case law that say where a company is functionally brought to its knees with respect to how it operates, that the appropriate measure of damages, the focus of the trial court's attention, should be on the valuation of that company that has been harmed. It's unclear whether or not that number might be higher or lower than the number that the court brought back in the form of lost profits in the way he went about doing the methodology. But what we're simply asking is that in terms of his decision of discussing how, because there was no restrictive covenant and that they could have left, that he then shifted over to that lost profits analysis and that constituted an abuse of discretion.
You're asking this court to remand, and you're saying it could still wind up with the same number or an even lower number?
It's possible that the number could be higher or lower, of course, depending on how it works through the valuation damages process. Yes. In essence, what we are asking the court to do is to say, look, based on the case law, based on the facts of the case.
And right. I know you want the trial court to address the issue differently,
mm-hmm.
but I'm thinking of it from a practical standpoint. Why would we send something back and ask the trial court to go through another process unless you're in a position to tell us that new, different process would result in some benefit to your client?
A great question. We presented evidence below through an expert that under a valuation damages model returned a significantly higher damages number than what the trial court came back with under lost profits. We believe that on remand, going through that process, if the judge is making the determination under a valuation methodology, that the number would end up higher. I am, however, realistic to put forth that the court will have discretion, of course, in terms of how it goes through with respect to calculating a valuation damages number in this case. And so those are the three primary arguments that are impacted by the findings of the trial court that there were breaches of the duty of loyalty by the individual defendants. There are a few remaining issues that we raise with respect to, and I'd be happy to discuss them at any length that Your Honors would like me to. There are the allegation with respect to overseas payments, in which the counsel for the appellants argue that certain payments that were made overseas totaling approximately $15 million should have been ordered in some way returned back to the company. And with respect to that, we put out in our brief the discussion of the acquiescence that took place on the part of Ms. Dweck and the individual appellants, as well as discuss the recent events that took place after the trial. And I'd be happy to discuss that. One point I'd simply like to make with respect to the acquiescence, which was clearly the finding that was taking place at the trial court level, that in the briefs here on appeal, the appellants try to argue that she was off the scene, that Ms. Dweck was off the scene, and therefore that she did not acquiesce. I will point out to Your Honors that, for example, with respect to the $5.2 or $5.3 million payment to Heckberg for the trademarks in May of 2005, that there's a discussion at page 10 of the opinion of how Dweck was involved, Ms. Dweck was involved in personally delivering the check, or one of the checks with relation to those payments.
Well, is there a judicial finding that Ms. Dweck acquiesced?
Yes, there was. There was a finding in the opinion with respect to that, and I can have that for you in just a moment, Your Honor. But not only the acquiescence, I did want to get out one additional comment or issue, because there's an issue that's raised in the appellant's briefs with respect to events that took place since the trial. And my fundamental point with in terms of what was recovered, what wasn't recovered, and the like, and what I'd simply posit or put forward to Your Honors is that submissions took place at the trial court level before the trial court issued its final order, holding that it was not going to direct any such return of payments. That those issues and those facts were presented to the trial court, and the trial court decided that he was not going to reopen or go back into that issue despite those submissions. With respect to the acquiescence finding, that's at page 41 of the court's opinion, the January 2012 opinion.
You say 21 or 41?
I apologize, Your Honor, 41. We also have arguments in the briefs, Your Honors, with respect to, aside from that overseas payment issue that is raised by the other side, with respect to attorney's fees, the finding on the part of the court that Ms. Dweck's behavior through her testimony approached bad faith, and putting those together with the uncontested breaches of the duty of loyalty, we believe constituted an abuse of discretion, while we understand the discretionary nature of that decision by the trial court. And then also, with respect to, and it's fully briefed by the appellees, is that the Court of Chancery erred with respect to ordering Mr. Nassar to return $3.8 million after a finding took place or a characterization on the part of the lower court that these payments constituted and were understood by the parties to effectively be distributions. Distributions from the company, that it then turned at the end of the opinion and said that it needed to look at it in terms of entire fairness because it was labeled as a consulting fee. And we believe, given the findings earlier in the opinion, that it consulted, that it constituted clear error. And finally, we would refer you to the brief with respect to an expense issue, which is under an abuse of discretion issue, the return of $2.4 million by Mr. Nassar. If Your Honors do not have any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At trial, we made every effort to assist the court in understanding the gravity and the nature of the tax evasion scheme, the structure. And I respectfully submit that any fair reading of Vice Chancellor Laster's decision would lead one to the ineluctable conclusion that he understood that it was a tax evasion scheme. He simply decided to cabin himself off. Those are his words. And it was his decision that it wasn't, a quote, having concluded that while the IRS may well be livid, quote, I put that in the category of not an issue for the Delaware Court of Chancery to worry about. Now, in answering the question you asked me earlier, we don't find an appellate decision, but we look at the cases we cite in our brief, and we don't see a case where there is the requirement of a sister court making a determination. So, for example, when Vice Chancellor Lamb in the Silver Lake case and the Klobbert case, there's a determination he makes that there's something wrong in Denmark, and he makes a sufficient inquiry to satisfy himself. If there was a requirement of a sister ruling, then it would be a rare day where a court in equity could tell somebody a pox on your house, because generally speaking, they come first seeking the relief. They don't wait to be indicted. They don't wait to be charged. Now, interestingly, in Vice Chancellor Laster's decision, he even goes on to say, look, if they end up, if a federal court ever does this, if a taxing authority ever does indict somebody or charge them, well, Kids International may then have the ability to come back and sue Ms. Dweck or Mr. Nasser. But you kind of, this was a derivative case. What Ms. Dweck was arguing when she came to Vice Chancellor Lamb in 2005 is stop. She effectively blew the whistle. Yes, she had acquiesced in 1998 because Mr. Nasser said, I know the deal was when I get my money back plus 10%, we're not sending any more abroad. But his words, you're a girl. I know better. You'll get your fair share. And she went along. But she went to court in March of 2005. That's when she was fired. She asked for a custodian to suggest that she acquiesced in another $15 or $18 million being sent abroad. Simply defies credulity. Now, interestingly, that $15 or $16 million, Mr. Nasser and his counsel at trial said she can have her share, her 30%. And you know what she said? You know what I said? No. It all belongs to Kids International. It all has to come back. It's not a tax distribution. It's not a dividend. It's a disguised payment. And I went on to say, it caused, and I'm quoting, it caused Kids International to file an 1120S and K-1s underreporting its income. Every dollar that went out, Uncle Sam lost 50 cents. Vice Chancellor Laster responded, look, I think that is probably right too. Close quote. He decided to cabin himself off because he did not believe that it was the responsibility of a judge sitting in Chancery Court to determine whether or not the claimed of conduct rested in illegality or even simple wrongdoing. Now.
So the remedy is to remand for him to consider whether or not this was an illegal tax evasion scheme and apply unclean hands. Is that correct?
That is an alternative. We believe that his findings, his factual findings, support but one conclusion, that there was an illegal scheme. He called it an overarching scheme. He found that...
Did he use the word illegal anywhere?
No, but he does say that it's an overarching scheme, and quote, Kids had been set up to funnel money tax-free out of the United States, close quote. what other interpretation can be given with a record that showed that, in fact, $30 million had gone abroad, that a critical link was there was no indicia of control, but yet he found that, indeed, these entities had been funded by Mr. Nasser, controlled by Mr. Nasser, and that, indeed, Ms. Dweck had a 30% stake in the proceeds. My colleague said that Mr. Nasser has never admitted that there was a tax evasion. I think there's a sleight of hand. He came to this court and said there's a tax evasion. His view is that if Ms. Dweck gets a withdrawn, he said there's a tax evasion. The tax evasion is at the kids' international level. It's not a matter of her getting a K-1 and not paying tax on the aliquot share of the distribution. It's the fact that the K-1 is understated because Kids International filed a false tax return. And guess who approved those returns every year? Not Ms. Dweck, but Mr. Nasser said he was in charge of financial affairs. He approved them, he'd either initial them or sign them. So the notion that Mr. Nasser doesn't know that there's a potential liability, it just is not supported by the record. Now, as to this $15 million, let's assume that Vice Chancellor was correct in assuming the legality of this overarching scheme to funnel money out of the country. Okay. Then why wouldn't he direct Mr. Nasser to bring back the $15 million that had clearly been paid without purpose? Instead, he said, well, he's promised to give her, he, Mr. Nasser, has promised to give Ms. Dweck her 30%. So given that, I don't really have anything to decide. We were insisting that it should all come back. Well, what happened? Okay, ruling, letter to Mr. Nasser's attorneys, Ms. Dweck would like her 30%. Answer, not from Mr. Answer, no. The money in Amsterdam has been stolen. The money I sent to Woodsford in my you know, to get around Mr. Keilman in Argentina, you can't have it. So we said to Vice Chancellor Laster, you predicated your ruling that there was no justiciable issue as related to the $15 million because he, Mr. Nasser, agreed to give her back her amount. He's breached. He's reneged. Please have him put all $15 million back in Kids International. That's where it belongs. That's so they can pay their creditors. That's so they can pay their taxing authorities. That's so they can file a tax return. And that way, the court in chancery will never be seen as having rendered a ruling that in some fashion condones what is, by every bit of evidence, a hideous tax scheme that was the essence of the structure of Kids International. I thank the court for its indulgence, and if you have no other questions, I will stand down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement to recess.